accession number 22371, Real 1.
John Howery 1, where were you born, please?
Where was I born? In Southsea, Hants.
Which year was this?
1922.
Did your ancestors come from Southsea?
My mother's family did. Portsmouth. Portsmouth and Southsea, you know.
And your father's family?
My father was a Londoner from a family of Irish immigrants.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Southsea?
No, grew up in India actually, and until I was 12, off and on. My father was part of the Indian Army, and they got a long leave every 4 or 5 years, something like several months leave. So when we were on leave, we went to school in England, and when it was not on leave, we went to school in India.
Whereabouts in India was that?
A place called Simla, which is in northern India, and it's in the Himalayas. A rather beautiful spot, delightful spot.
Do you have memories of Simla?
Oh, very pleasant, yes. Very pleasant memories, yeah. It's real mountain country. Have you been to the Alps or... Well, it's that sort of mountains. Pine forests, snow in the winter. Delightful, you know, millions of acres of playground.
How old were you when you finished schooling?
In India. In India, yes. 12. I came home to England when I was 12. We had a couple of years of illness in the family, and my father decided that was the time to call it a day. So we came home and we were plonked into boarding school.
In Hampshire?
Yes, in Portsmouth.
Were you still schooling when war was declared?
Yeah, yes I was.
Whereabouts?
In Southsea.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Under what
circumstances? Yes, I heard that broadcast. I was staying with relatives at Seaford in Sussex. We went to Mass on a Sunday morning, and on the way back in my aunt's car, we pulled into a petrol station, and he said, well, hurry up, because the Prime Minister's going to talk in 5 minutes. So we rushed home, and there he was, speaking all that he had to say. In a way, it was quite exciting. He had not finished speaking many minutes before there was an air raid siren. This is quite a well-known tale. It was somebody had overreacted, I think, something like that. Anyway, we'd all heard stories and we'd seen films of what had gone on in the Spanish Civil War and so on with aircraft, and being on the south coast, we felt somewhat vulnerable. Anyway, the all clear went. And about 5 minutes later, a company of soldiers marched up the road outside the house. And we thought, our brave boys going off to war. When I knew the army better, I realised what had happened was the officers couldn't think of anything else to do, so they told them to go and have a march. That's about the standard of army thinking in those days. Anyway, they not a bad thing to do, actually. It does keep them fit and occupied. And marching is a vital part of a soldier's talents.
So you didn't feel any sense of dismay about the announcement?
Not at all, no. No, it was all rather exciting.
Did the war affect you at first?
Not really, no. Various relatives rolled up. They got out of London. One of my aunts, I remember, got a taxi out of London. The taxi driver was probably quite glad to get out of London himself, but anyway. Everyone thought London is an obvious target, and everyone thought the war would start that minute, because it didn't. And anyway, places like Seaford on the south coast, Brighton, Eastbourne, you see, that's where people went. And many of them stayed the war down there.
Were you in employment in the early part of the war?
No, I was still at school. I finished my schooling in 1940, and I took them the trick. The exams you took in those days were the school certificate followed by a matriculation, which gave you an entrance to university or to various other things. And the trick was the magic word. I then took the Civil Service Commissioner's exam, which was a sort of standard exam they produced to mainly for the commission ranks of the services. Took that at Winchester, I remember. And in due course was called up by the army under a special scheme, I then being just 18. And so all we 18-year-olds were called up on that scheme to a place called Borden Camp, which is the back of the island. Nonetheless, it's a big barracks. There's quite a lot of barracks. It's a sort of offshoot of Aldershot, I suppose. In those days, the army had its own railway from Guildford to Borden. And so we were told, we got some travel warrants, I suppose. The minute we get to Guildford, and you get in this army railway, you see, the army train.
What was it like?
Well, it was like, there were trains on sort of sidelines tended to be a bit primitive in those days, and that's what it was like. It chugged along. I can't remember any other reactions to it. I just remember arriving at Borden Station, which can't have been much of a station, but anyway, there was a platform on which we all congregated. And there were a couple of hundred of us, and so we were divided into groups of about 30, I suppose. I don't know what arrangement there was. And a sergeant took charge of us, and he said, well, try and march if you can. You know, your luggage will go up in the wagon. So we marched up to the barracks. And as we got there, there seemed to be a head stuck out of every window. They're all shouting, before you come up, son, which I thought was a very strange thing to shout. What they were trying to establish was their seniority over us. Most of them had only been there a week anyway. that being the nature of youth and squaddies. We then settled in and had about 3 months of intense square bashing, gun drill, physical gymnasium, inoculations, all the things that the army does in its recruits program. And I think actually did us all a pair of good. We learned how to march. That was an important thing. You can look at an army going past and you know whether it's a trained army or not by just how it marches. So there's a style to it which affects everybody. The reason at reunions all these old squaddies are all pushing on 80, but they can all march because they learned how to do it when they were 18 years old, and you know, you do it.
But why did it do you so much good?
It made you fit. Fitter than we were, you know, we thought we were fit. We had to be reasonably fit, I suppose. You know, teenagers tended to be fairly fit, and we were a well-fed group. We were a middle-class group. You know, so we hadn't suffered from the depression by starvation and things like that, which other people had, as I discovered later. Anyway, that was fairly intense, and I don't remember that we got allowed out of the place at any time. I remember my first pay was 7 and 6 pence, 7 shillings and 6 pence. You can translate that into normal money. It's a little over a third of a pound, isn't it?
Probably under a third, anyway.
Well, anyway, whatever it is. You know, it's in that area, isn't it? You know, I could stop and work it out, but I, you know. Lived quite well on it, actually. You see, there was only spending money. The army had a scheme where they kept back some of your pay, and it accumulated, and you could have it when you went on leave, which actually was a very good scheme. And I'm told it was instituted by Florence Nightingale. Prior to her, they gave the soldier his pay and he went and drank it straight away. She instituted these various plans and the army cooperated. Anyway, I thought, in retrospect, I think it's a good idea. Anyway, having finished that, we went off to various universities, and there were four or five universities we divided ourselves into. And I went to Glasgow University. I rather think we went to universities according to the alphabetical order, because I realised that all the people I remember from that area had names in the early part of the alphabet. And I've met... Have you met Wilkinson in Northampton?
Is he the chap who's written a book about Arnhem?
Mm.
Yes.
Yeah. He went to Edinburgh. You see, he was W and I was H. So why did he go to Edinburgh? And I decided that was probably the reason why. Some clerk said, right, send that lot there, this lot here. That's how things are done. Anyway, the army decided they wouldn't pay us. So 6 months we were to be living in Glasgow. We got bed and breakfast and an evening meal. But we did not get paid. You see. Didn't suit anybody. They gave us a shilling a day for lunch. And we discovered that the YMCA produced lunch for 11 pence halfpenny if you were a serviceman. If you can, you know, you understand the arithmetic of this.
Can you explain?
Right, there's 12 pennies in a shilling, so 11 pence halfpenny, you had a halfpenny left over. At the end of the week, you had 5 halfpennies, which is 2.5 pence left over, which I suppose is 6 pence today, or whatever it is. Anyway. You weren't going to enjoy the flesh pots of this great city, Glasgow, on 2.5 pence. So we all trundled down, the six of us went down the Labour Exchange. The fellow treated us with great suspicion, because we were all in uniform. Marched in. We want a job. Anyway, we finally, he gave us a job, fire watching. Fire watching, if you don't know, was a method where the firms used to supplement their sort of night watchman staff by people who would deal with incendiary bombs. And you had the equipment. You put a wet sandbag over it and hid while it exploded. Or as one of the chaps said to me, you just get the hell out of it. Anyway, we're in a whiskey bonded warehouse, and tell you what, this was a world I had no knowledge of whatsoever. The back streets of Glasgow was warehouses. The poor, if you like. The sort of people who work there. Broad Scots. Quite lovely people, actually. But complete new thing to me. Anyway, a relative sent me £5, which was a fortune. So I invested it in in a pair of dancing pumps and a set of ballroom dancing lessons, which served me very well for years. One of the best investments I ever made. And that qualified me, in my own eyes anyway, to go to the University Union Ball, which was quite a glittering affair, despite the war, with all the Scotsmen in their various tartans, and I mean, you could imagine Glasgow, what it attracted. Ladies all turned out. Ladies always turn out looking good, or events like that. And, you know, it was a great event. To my 18-year-old eyes, it was a very great event. I took a girl that I met at the dancing school to the union. I didn't know anybody else. Anyway, later on, we enjoyed the flesh pots of Glasgow. Skating rinks. Mm-hmm. Drink didn't play a big part in our lives, you know, things like that. We were not, you know, it was a fairly innocent time. The only thing we were after, really, was women. You know, we'd suddenly realise that there they were. And there was a big ballroom in Glasgow, and the resident band was Joe Loss. You hear Joe Loss played to this day, don't you? Mm-hmm. So I did all my early dancing to Joe Loss. Couldn't be better. It wasn't until a long time afterwards I realised quite what a privilege that was, because other bands, you didn't get the same quality of music. But old Joe Loss did. I also didn't realise that, you see, men go to dance halls, pick up girls. What I didn't realize, the girls go downstairs to be picked up. That's a second part of the equation that didn't occur to me until years later. And I thought, all the fuss we all made about how you'd pick up a girl, and then they were just waiting to be picked up. We picked them up, all right. Or they picked us up, whichever it was, and we had a very good time. He went out onto Loch Lomond, and the university was good, and lectures, parades with the university, army, cadet corps, an HLI sergeant, HLI, Highland Light Infantry. Highland Light Infantry are recruited in the back streets of Glasgow. And he was, and he was a tough old sod, who had seen 50 years' service, 150 years' service, whatever, it was written all over him. I think, anyway, he was a tough old sod, and he stuck in my memory. The first time he paraded us, and there must have been some reason why we paraded, but anyway, we did, and we marched past somewhere with Sergeant Mulligan, and he had tears in his eyes, and he said, I've never seen marching like it. I didn't realise. See, we were young and fit, and we had been trained, you know, by a drill squad, by a drill instructor, where Sergeant Mulligan had spent a life with people from the back streets of Glasgow who didn't take very kindly to doing it. I beg your pardon. And, you know, not just little things like that I remember about him. Anyway.
Were you learning much?
At the university, yeah, I did, yes. The maths and science I didn't learn very much. I really knew it all already. You know, it was going over the same ground. The chemistry was fuels and explosives, and surveying, which was quite a significant thing. And we went all round the grounds of the university there with theodolites, planning this, that, and the other. And, yeah, it was quite good fun. I'd driven back there not that many years ago. It hadn't changed very much. The same hillsides and buildings, the same benchmarks that you use to start your surveying. Anyway, that finished, you know, at the end of whatever, 6 months or 8 months. And we then reported to and became officer cadets. And all of a sudden the whole tempo of life changed. And that was a rugged time, where you were expected to march and run faster and further than you thought possible. And where in between it you were supposed to attend lectures on law and tactics and organisation, maintenance of vehicles, gunnery, I don't know, all the various things that went to it. Very intense and very useful, actually. It was a cram, you know. It was something like about a 3-year course crammed into 6 months. So it was crammed. And I did all that at Ilkley in Yorkshire. And I knew every inch of those moors because I'd sweated over them. And spent nights in the Pennines and things like that. When you qualified there and you became a second lieutenant, you really felt you had achieved something. You know, the intensity of it all. They were keen to get you through the course, but I didn't see life like that in those days. They pushed you around. Anyway, the assistant troop commander of the troop I was in when I was a cadet was a fella called, No, we better forget about that one. You know, he just came up later on in my life. Anyway, I left there and I was commissioned as a second lieutenant, and I thought I was the cat's whiskers. Until I got to my unit, and I was soon made to realise that a second lieutenant is not the cat's whiskers. You are nobody at all. There are whole echelons of people who've been through it all and put in years of service and had ranks senior to you.
Which unit did you go to?
It was called the 90th Anti-Tank. Around 90th Anti-Tank Regiment.
Where did you find them?
They were in Essex, at a place called Frinton. Frinton's a very select place. We then left there. We left Essex and we went to Northern Ireland. And I must say, I had several months in Northern Ireland and I thoroughly enjoyed it. Lovely people, delightful place. Place of great contrasts. The people, you know, are contrasts. It's sad that they don't get on with each other. I don't have a ready answer to that subject. But on both sides of their own divide, they are lovely people who are most hospitable to us as soldiers. I was a Catholic lieutenant in the British Army, so I was, under one title or another, I was invited into various houses. They all had daughters, and we all thoroughly enjoyed them. And what do you want when you're 19, 20, you know? You don't get a lot of time off anyway. And I made friends there, which have remained friends for the rest of my life. They're lovely people.
Where were you stationed in Northern Ireland?
All sorts of places. Portrush, to start with, then Ballycastle, Guildford County down. I could go on and on. Antrim. Never stayed anywhere very long. I did a battle school, if you know what a battle school is. A battle school is a month of intense soldiering where you run everywhere. And you play soldiering in all sorts of different ways with a lot of live ammunition and things like that. Lift mines and wade rivers, climb rocks, cliffs. In fact, the battle school was one of the best things I did. Becoming an officer was an important part of it, but that battle school, that intense month, to realise that war is a fairly demanding programme and there's no halfway. The people who are halfway get killed, you know, and you've got to survive. And they set about trying to teach you how to survive. And they were very good. We started each day by running about a mile. And if you'd been on the beer the night before, well, bloody hard luck. That's your fault. You learned not to do it. Anyway, we went all round the mountains of Mourne, spent the night on top of Slieve Dunard, which is the tallest mountain there. There it's a rugged, rocky pile of, you know, mountains. And played soldiers up there. And, you know, it was quite good fun. But pretty intense. And I could tell you, in the middle of the night, on top of the mountain, it's bloody cold.
Did you just sleep out in the open?
Yeah. Yeah, they taught you soldiering the rugged way. If you can't make yourself comfortable, that's your problem, mate. They did this much the same when we were cadets. I'll tell you. We climbed Great Wernside, you know, the Pennines, when I was a cadet. Spent the night on the top. And they just left us to make our own devices. Well, they were odd sort of shepherd's huts and things like that. And, you know, we made ourselves as comfortable as possible. Got up the next morning and no one had slept very well. We then marched about 35 miles cross country, across very rugged country. And I know it's 35 miles because it was measured on the map. And we arrived at a little place called Muger, where there was Nissen huts. And they were damp and cold. And it was something like December, I think, or anyway, it was winter. And that's where we would spend the night. So we went in and flopped down. We were all so tired after all this running around the countryside that we could have slept anywhere. And before we got to sleep, a fellow burst in and said, "Hey, there's a dance at the local tonight." Do you know, within seconds, everybody was chafing. Polishing their boots. You never seen it? Sex, sex plays a big part in anybody's life. Now the girls came in from, the girls came in from the local farms. And many of them put in an hour's walk to get there. So the squaddy said to a girl, can I take you home? He had a 2 hour walk on top of all he'd done all day. Nonetheless, the next day, we played soldiers around Malham, Malham Tarn, you know, quite a famous rock climbing area. Went back to Ilkley, and we were commissioned. We, that night we became second lieutenants. I thought we were no end of the bee's knees. Anyway, the battle school, you know, it was rugged. It was meant to be rugged. It was meant to be tough. And if you had to go 20 miles, well, you can double it. No question of getting a lift. That's how they... That was how it was in the battle school. You were meant to be a tough soldier. And if you weren't, you got a bad report. There were all ranks there, and it wouldn't have behoved an officer at all well to get a bad report. So he didn't want to. I suppose the average squad, he wouldn't have worried very much. But, anyway, he flogged around, and it was quite good. Anyway, towards the end of 1943, the army was getting it reorganized, ready for D-Day. You know, units were coming back from the Mediterranean, and you know, the Montgomery was taken over, and all those sort of things had happened. And they decided that they would disband the division that we were in. And the unit I was in was disbanded. And I ended up in a reinforcement holding unit on Otterburn Moor, which is, I don't know, halfway between Newcastle and Carlisle, I suppose that's where it is, you know, in the Pennines.
Scottish border.
Scottish border. I understand it was famous for a great battle there, but why anyone should fight over it, because there was bugger all there except sheep. And we played soldiers around there, and it was a miserable existence. From being, you know, someone of importance in the unit you're in, I've rather skipped over part of it, but anyway, from being of someone of importance, suddenly you weren't, you've been kicked around. Also, I rather fancied myself around about then as a troop commander. Now, there was I, 19, as a brand new second lieutenant. I joined the 90th. I'd gone back in my life, right? And after a short interval, I was assigned to a particular battery, and the battery commander, whose name was John Howard, interviewed, and he said, I'm going to give you a troop. I want troop commanders, that's why I've asked for you. He said, I might as well be honest, the troop you're getting is the worst troop in the regiment. It is just mutinied. In fact, the troop commander and the troop sergeant have been put on draft in North Africa to get rid of them. And I went and saw these little scraps. They'd been pushed around. That was my estimate. You know, I took them all up to a hut and said, well, you better tell me what it's all about. And they all tell me the tale. They're all somewhat inarticulate backstreet boys. Some of them had grown up in, not exactly postals, but orphanages and so on. They'd been pushed around all their lives. And along came my predecessor who set about shouting at them. And they just reacted. They went down on the ranges and they fired every round off the target. It's quite a telling. Well, anyway, that had its effect. They had planned it. So I did a deal with them that the past wasn't the past and let's forget all about it, but there's no reason why we shouldn't be the best troop in the regiment. And we set about doing it because they were young and, you know, keen-eyed and so on. And we started winning prizes in regimental competitions, which were quite good. I was not short of saying my say, and
this was the 90th anti-tank regiment.
90th anti-tank. Now, there was a very good second-in-command there, the 90th Anti-Tank. Right. And he deserves a mention. He was known as Foster. He was Major Foster. He was a regular who had joined the ranks and had gone up through, you know, all the various ranks. And he had it written all over him. And he was smart. Fastidious, but really smart. And he took the training of lieutenants under his wing, the training of all officers. And we had all sorts of evenings round the sand table while he fired questions at you. The army had a sequence of doing things.